Hey there, I'm David Kern.
I'm Heidi White.
I'm Tim McIntosh.
And I'm Sean Johnson.
And you are listening to Close Reads, a podcast for the Incurable Reader, on which we are discussing Hernan Diaz's Trust. Part two is the section that we will be focusing on. It's a difficult thing to say, it turns out. We're going to dig into that. It means we can talk a little bit more about the secrets, with the mysteries, the things that we were only suggesting, that we were skirting around last episode. Thanks to everyone who's listening. Thanks to everyone who supports the show. Don't forget, you can listen to Sean over on The Daily Poem, that you can listen to Sean, Heidi, and I over on Close Reads HQ, where we were discussing mystery novels. Most recently, you'll have already had a chance to listen to Josephine Tay's, our discussion on Josephine Tay's The Franchise Affair. And of course, our series on Christian Lovensutter continues unto the ages of ages. Tim, what are you up to these days?
Just recorded Merry Wives of Windsor with Sarah Jane Bentley over on The Plays the Thing, your one-stop shop for all things Shakespeare. Soon, the four of us, the recording that the four of us did on King John will also release. So my calendar is relatively, my dance card is kind of a little bit open right now.
Oh, is it?
It
because
is.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because we had talked at one point. Actually, you weren't able to come, but you know, there was a little gathering here for an event, and
yeah.
Daniel Nyeri and Heidi and Sean came to town, and while we were here, we made a little list of possible things that we could discuss on the podcast together, just as some extra bonus episodes. And I thought before we dive into Trust, we could just kind of cover a few of these and see if any of these stand out to you guys as things we might want to do this summer. A little programming discussion here in front of everybody. We'll take 5 minutes on this. And we'll get into Trust.
Let's do it.
And since Sean's got Tim's got an open dance card.
Yeah.
Sean also is looking for a dance partner. So we're going to try to figure out how to make this all work together. Okay, here's some things we discussed. We discussed the idea of doing some Hall of Fames. So we could do we try to create the Hall of Fame of a certain author. So for example, we could do the P.G. Wodehouse Hall of Fame. When we try to say, if P.G. Wodehouse was in the Literary Hall of Fame, what would be the works that would be written on his plaque? We could also do Shakespeare, but maybe that one's too easy. Speaking of Wodehouse, we could do an episode on the top 5 literary butlers. That was one we discussed. We also discussed the best books with numbers in the title.
Yeah, so, I like that.
You know, 1984, for example. We discussed lighthearted books to escape the apocalypse. That might have been good right around how we were doing The Road. We could do our favorite books about travel. That might be a good summer one.
Oh, yeah.
We also discussed our top 5 books about food. That would be making it at five, that would be brutal. We could talk about biographies, our favorite biographies. Tim, I know you're a biography...
connoisseur.
That'd be a great one.
Connoisseur, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I am.
We have discussed close rereads, and I think that might be something we should just save for every year. We should do one book we've done on the show before and reintroduce that. Maybe we save that for next year, or when we make our list next time. Top 5 literary locations we talked about. Top 5 literary mentors. Top 5 most tragic literary deaths. I mean, there's just so many things we could talk about here. We could also do Hall of Fames on pretty much any author that has a decent, canon.
Yeah.
Exactly. Any of these stand out to you, Tim? You mentioned the
biographies. What is a literary mentor?
Like a Dumbledore.
Like Alfred.
Okay.
Like Alfred.
Or I think is he biographies. The best literary butler? Ooh.
Wow. And do comic books count as literature?
And Jeeves could also be a mentor and a butler.
Exactly.
Right, that's fair. Wow. Top 5 mentors/butlers.
So, Tim, you want to do biographies?
I would love to do biographies.
What if do top 5 biographies on people who were mentors and or butlers?
Oh my gosh.
I bet
shrunk
Tim's
our Venn diagram a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay, so Tim, you'd be in for you'd be willing to put a biographies episode on your dance card.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Okay. God, nice.
Okay. Sean, what stands out to you?
I love all of those. I really do like the top 5 butlers idea. top 5 books on food. These seem like fun ways to squeeze in nonfiction. We've talked about that in the past.
Mm, that's a great point.
Yeah.
Heidi, what stands out to you?
Literary deaths. That's what I want to do.
Yeah, well, that's a good one too. Yeah.
Most tragic literary deaths. We could make a nice long list on that, and then try to narrow it down to 5 would be brutal.
Food and travel, that's usually what I like to read about in the summer anyway. So
Travel, that's true. Fun. Travel would be a good one for for the summer. Maybe we could, on that episode, we could talk at length about how we're going to be doing an event in England next summer. And we could incorporate that into that. Yeah,
it's going to include food, travel, and may or may not include a butler.
Well, we're going to be in England.
Fingers crossed. Yeah.
What kind of trip do you... I mean, it might be Sean, but Sean puts on his best tweed and he butlers for you.
Buttles.
He buttles.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I do think Hall of Fame episodes would be pretty fun too, because we could just grab, like I said, any author.
I'm so excited about rereads.
Yeah.
We definitely need to do that, because there's a lot of books that we've done over the years that, frankly, I don't remember what we said. And
a lot of hurt feelings I have for not being involved in some of them.
Ditto.
So,
yeah. Heidi, this is our chance.
Hey, Tim, why don't you and I do Brideshead Revisited, just the two of us?
Any hurt feelings. That's great. Just
I love
it. Put it out there.
So with the rereads, would we do the whole book again, or would we just be like a one episode kind of, hey, I know we already talked about this
book. No, we do the whole book again.
Really?
So we do, you know, some people have sent me messages saying like, hey, you should do, or some of the ones people have sent me,
Brideshead Revisited.
You know what gets mentioned by multiple people is Crossing to Safety. People liked that book.
That was such a good series. Yeah, that was great.
So the idea is, I mean, some of them, not everyone was involved in. So the idea is we just go back and we do something. I mean, the whole point of the show is that, you know, books are rereadable. I mean,
you can't do it actually, in one go.
That's right. Yeah.
Anyway,
speaking of books that are rereadable, three of us are reading Trust for the second time. And then there's Sean. And we're going to talk about part two this week. So, we'll make some final decisions on schedules for this summer programming to do some additional things, in addition to just things that people can listen to when they're in the car with people who may not be reading along with them. Say you're traveling with your spouse and you're driving to the mountains or the beach and your spouse is like, I'm not listening to Trust. I'm not reading Trust. I don't want to listen to these people talk about a book I haven't read before, but they might be willing to listen to you, to some people that they don't know, talk about butlers, because who doesn't want to do that? So some summer programming ideas for you, but Trust, Sean, you, we talked about how we're going to draft on your ignorance in this series.
Wouldn't be the first time.
But we'll come to that later.
I think it would literally be the first time, because you usually know more than us about everything.
Well, maybe, okay, then not the first time in my life.
Okay.
Okay. Fair. Yeah. He is married.
That's right.
And he's a man. So, Tim, I want to come to you first, speaking of being married and a man, because this character in this book is also married and a man.
Hey, and twins.
In that way and no other ways, Tim is a twin with this character.
It's fabulous wealth as well.
That's right. I forgot about that.
That's right.
So one of the questions I started with last week is whose sympathies are part one with, the novel within the novel. Who is that most sympathetic to in terms of Helen or What Benjamin? The names are all throwing me off because I just read the version. Switch. Yeah. So in this section, though, I want to take that same question and ask it a little bit differently. Do you think that Hernan Diaz, the author, wants us to come out of section two feeling strongly one way or the other about the character who is ostensibly writing working on his memoir? It's obviously unfinished, right? It's just, there's lots of places where it's just, write more about this, do you think that he wants us to feel strongly one particular way about that memoirist?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Could you say more about that?
I think that he wants us to finish this section, I think, full of venom for the autobiographer. It's not really an autobiography. It's really kind of, how do you say it in Latin? Apologia pro vita sua, a defense of my life, The more he defends his own life, the smaller he looks, the more he sounds like someone who whose life is like shrinking by the moment. It's funny, the number of times that he says, and I recognize, and I come from a long line of people who recognize that self-interest can be good for the common good. And you're like, hey, maybe if you said it just one more time, you'll believe it. Just say it once more and you'll believe it. Now, I'm putting aside the question of whether or not Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations is correct when he says that like motivated self-interest can serve the common good. Like that's a claim that Adam Smith, I'm not weighing in on that. It's just, it seems so clear to me that our autobiographer does not, how do I say it, feels incredible guilt over the things that he's done in the stock market that he just kind of has to keep saying, yeah, I did this for the common good. This was not just about me. This was about serving the common good. And it's just like, Andrew, bro, just be honest. Andy. You wanted to make a lot of money.
Come
like,
on, guys.
You wanted to make a lot of money.
Hey, so I was thinking about you a lot during this section, in part because of your wealth, but also because of Ayn Rand. And I was wondering if you think that maybe Ayn Rand was inspired
so
by this
many times.
Autobiography.
This, I really did feel like this was, this is Ayn Rand. If she had been a successful entrepreneur, which actually she probably was a very successful entrepreneur, but if she had just dedicated her whole life to like accumulating massive wealth through the stock market, and then she wrote a defense of that life afterwards,
it would be this.
It would be this. It is so Ayn Randian.
It would be longer, but it would be this. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be longer. A little bit more purple prose, but it would be this. Yeah.
Well, I will talk about the prose aspects of this section. Do you feel the same way? Like, do you come out of this section feeling venomously towards the autobiographer?
I feel like I can't really say publicly how I feel about him yet because so much yet is left to come.
Oh, man.
But I really think he's justifying himself. And it raises the question of why, right? For someone who has lived clearly so selfishly for so long and seems to take pride in his withdrawal from society and his apparent contempt for public praise or knowledge or whatever, prestige. Why? Right? Like, why write this? And why choose what he justifies? Tim, you brought up how he justifies his greed, right? And tries to explain it and put his actions into this light as to, like, seeming to truly believe that if he says it this way, people will trust him and give him the benefit of the doubt and stop judging him, right? So that's one thing he justifies. The other thing is he takes very great pains to present his relationship with his wife in a certain way and his home life, right? And the effort he puts into both of those things raises so many questions to me as to what is the purpose of this written work? Why do it after so long? Even the first line, which actually the first line's pretty good, or at least intriguing. I don't know if it's necessarily good writing, but and he says, my name is known to many, my deeds to some, my life to few. And then he kind of goes on and says, he tries to say why he's writing it, but he never gives a true, what I think is a satisfying or sufficient account of this section. So I come to the end of it with a clearer picture of who he is, but I'm not sure what he wants. And that is intriguing to me.
How about you, Sean? Do you know what he wants?
I'm not sure I know what he wants. But I think he reveals more than he intends to reveal. That's the, you know, the beauty of this section. So you, yeah. you look at the things that he just, he doesn't write about, or the places where he has notes to go in and fill in later, like his grandmother and increasingly his wife. And then even the places where he is forthcoming with information, like the way he excuses his absence during his wife's death, are so minimal compared to the final sections that are a justification of his own professional genius and altruism. It's a pretty damning section. And that he excuses himself, or he denigrates other financial investors for simply trying to accomplish what he successfully accomplished, as if the rules are different for people like him who are already rich and the people who wanted to get rich like him.
So it sounds to me like it's a great mercy that this is a short section to you guys.
It's just long enough.
Yeah.
Tim, you're nodding.
Well, I mean, last week I said this was my favorite section, and it's a pretty despicable character writing a pretty despicable section. So I feel like I need to give my own apology to Pro Vita Sua.
Well, and I'll just say in support of you, that totally makes sense. I loved the way this section was working.
Yeah.
Yeah, like dramatically, like what it's doing in the novel. Well, go ahead, Tim, defend yourself.
Please.
Well, it just, with everything that he says, he digs the mystery a little bit deeper about what is going on in this book.
Yeah.
But what I love about it is that it already feels like there is a resolution to this. Like, okay, for example, I was comparing this to a book like The Sound and the Fury. The Sound and the Fury is four different parts told in four different voices, and a lot of what is being covered are the same events. And you just get these very different perspectives on it. That book is an all-time masterpiece, right? But it's also frustrating in a way that this book feels really rewarding, which is kind of like at the end of it, at the end of The Sound and the Fury, you've got four different views on common events. This one feels like there's some common events and we get four different perspectives, but there's something to be unearthed here. There's some mystery to be divined here. And the harder that Andrew Bevel digs, the deeper he digs, the more our curiosity kind of wants to see what's at the bottom of that pit that he's digging.
Yeah, this reminds me a lot of The Rector of Justin.
Two big sections,
another book,
right,
we did
Sean?
On the show.
Yeah. Say that again, Tim.
Two big sections or three?
I think it's more like four or five.
Okay.
I mean,
okay.
there is kind of a framing narrator, but he's going around and collecting different stories about the life of the Rector of Justin, who has died. Right? And so you are essentially getting biography after biography. And they don't always gel. Sometimes they contradict each other in significant ways. And it feels like the man at the center of them all is a big mystery that you're working towards, you know, coming to understand or unravel over the course of the novel.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good comparison.
Different guy, though.
different
yeah,
guy.
Yeah, very different guy.
So go ahead, Heidi.
Well, I kind of want to hear what you're about to ask.
Well,
because
I
it might be related to this.
Well, it is sort of, but it's also like taking us somewhere new. So if you want to,
I just want to talk about the differences between sections one and two.
Okay,
if you're going to ask that later, I will wait for that.
Let me ask you this because I think this will take us around to that.
Yeah.
So we've kind of been suggesting that maybe the writing here in this section is not great, right? And I mentioned that it's basically an unfinished memoir autobiography.
Like now, a manuscript.
Right. So that could reveal a few things here. And on the one hand, maybe it forces us to say, well, this is an unfinished thing. He's just getting stuff out on paper. It's not polished. It's not revised. It's on the one hand, that can be sort of, as you said, Sean, damning. It's like the true self coming out with that hasn't been censored. On the other hand, maybe it could have been, maybe if he had a chance to polish it, we got the final version of it. Yeah. He's able to flesh out ideas and he becomes a little more sympathetic that way. And, you know, most people don't want their true selves ultimately just uncensored, right? So what is the impact or the purpose from Diaz's perspective, do you think, in making this memoir, autobiography, or manuscript unfinished and ultimately not that great in terms of the writing? Do you have thoughts on that, Heidi?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a huge key to this section. And I think it reveals, as Sean said, this whole autobiography, memoir, whatever it is very, very revelatory in a way that Andrew Bevel does not intend, right? He is intending to justify himself. Instead, he opens himself to being understood, I think, in a way that he wouldn't like, that he would deplore, right? Because he seems to want to be admired and excused. And instead, he is putting himself out there for criticism from moral people.
Who he's probably ultimately trying to justify himself to in the first place.
Yep. And before he writes this, and since it's a manuscript, we know it's not published, which raises questions, right? Before this is written and put out there, he may be judged in public scrutiny, but there is something always admirable about somebody who is judged or condemned and doesn't respond. And so for him to put something like this out, he's going to get the same condemnation because he just doesn't come across well. And he makes himself look weaker. He undermines himself because now he's trying to get public approval. And so we actually think less of him and will disrespect him, which shows a lack of understanding of himself. And so in that way, he's more and more self-revelatory, as well as us being able, if we're savvy readers, to read between the lines, right? Which is something Hernan Diaz puts, he gives us enough to be psychologically compelling on Andrew Bevel's part, but also for us to be able to read between the lines. And so it's masterful writing on Hernan Diaz's part because he's writing from the perspective of a flawed person trying to be perceived as better, but we can see him really for who he is. It's incredible writing on Diaz's part. It's really subtle. It's very skilled. In the hands of a lesser writer, it would have fallen completely flat. Plus, we have the added layer of interpretation of being able to compare it with the fictionalized novel about this same imaginary person's imaginary self or imaginary other, right? So there's multiple layers of incredible storytelling that's taking place in just these two sections, and we still have half the novel left.
My favorite self-revelatory comment is when he compares himself to a great artist because he's good at buying art.
I know.
Okay, I got questions about that kind of comment too, but go ahead, Tim.
For me, Sean, it was when he's talking about his wife's kind of, you know, desire to support the arts, and he writes a sentence, I wish I had it in front of me, that said more about the art that she supported or something like that. And it's like so clearly like he has no concept whatsoever. Whereas on the other hand, and I'm supporting your point, Heidi, that like it's the omissions that are like almost the most noteworthy thing in this section of the book. When he speaks about financial collapse or the people who were flooding into, you know, the stock market, including women. I mean, that part was like, can you believe it?
Could there have been any greater indication of the coming decline?
Right. That's a little bit of a, like, that's a pretty nice touch though by Diaz because it's so of its time.
Right.
Right. Yeah, so. For sure. Right, for sure.
Which that doesn't excuse it. I'm just saying that's like a nice bit of... It's like,
it makes it even more plausible. Yeah. You're like, this is something that this guy would write. But he writes with such, I'm going to call it fluidity, when he's talking about the market and he's talking about bank failures and he's talking about, you know, subprime interest, those sorts of things. He has such an eloquence and like a driving passion. And then when he gets closer to things that we would think, oh, these are the things that you actually should care about, your wife, her benevolent associations, the amount of money that you're giving toward people who are struggling, on those issues, he becomes very, it's like the watercolor kind of approach, like very distant, very opaque, lots of platitudes, but with such specificity when he deals with
lots of platitudes.
Like, As compared to cases, like the specificity of the market.
And in most cases on those situations, he writes a little bit and he's like, more later.
Yeah, right.
Come back to
my favorite is when he says, make accessible to the average reader.
Oh, he says that multiple times.
There's a really poignant...
Which actually is fair. I appreciate that coming from somebody that has managed to work the stock market. There's a lot of things in this book that I'm like, okay, I do know what that means. This is accessible to me, the average reader. But it also tells you something about this person.
Yeah.
For sure. It's plausible, but also communicates his as overinflated sense of his own importance and intelligence.
Right. Well, it's interesting because there's this really poignant moment where he's talking about Mildred and he wants to describe how essentially she makes his life better. And I think it's like at the end of the chapter and at the top of the page, all of a sudden it just ends with the verb was. And then underneath it, he writes, write more later about how Mildred made my life better. And he can't finish the thought. He can't express the idea. And on the one hand, you could say he doesn't have the capacity to express something as important as that. And on the other, you could say, well, maybe he really does want to get it right. And the thing for me about him is that I think there's at least a little bit of him wanting to get it right, while also being consumed with his own reputation, how he's remembered. And I do think that how you're remembered is a huge theme in this book. You know, the idea of what's the legacy that you're going to pass on. And I think ultimately that's part of why he's probably writing this, is he wants to produce a book that's going to allow his and her legacy to be, like, legacy is the ultimate good other than the dollar. So he really cares about how that he gets remembered in 100 years. And this book is going to set the record straight on that. So I think with Diaz, like, if you want to be a little sympathetic to him, Diaz allows you to have a few reasons to do that. And then you run into the barrier of just when you think you want to be sympathetic to him. Oh, his life was difficult. Oh, you know, whatever. His absent father. Then he kind of pulls it out and he says, yeah, but also ultimately this guy's kind of a creep. Heidi, you unmuted yourself.
I just think this section's so poignant.
Okay.
Like it's so moving to me. But that can only be understood backwards because this is a book that reveals itself backwards.
Yeah, we're kind of talking around it. Hey, yeah. Sean, is our narrator in this section revealing himself as a bad guy or just a guy with a small soul? Side note, which is worse?
I know. I was going to say. Curious how you're going to answer this.
Yeah.
question stands.
I don't think they're mutually exclusive, but that the smaller the soul, the less bad maybe you're capable of. I think that there's maybe a little bit of both going on. He certainly has a hard time understanding people and even caring a lot about people. Or, you know, the normal, you know, transcendent, beautiful things and experiences of life, which he feels like he has a mastery of because he can buy them, but which is really depressing and makes him pitiable. And so there you go. I think he's pitiable here. He has done some bad that he's not convinced he's guilty of. But I think that's also due to being a small-souled person more than it is to being a villain unknowingly.
Tim,
do you guys think that there's any evidence about what his prime motive for writing the autobiography is within the text? And
in this section?
In this section. We just got done reading a novel that is loosely or maybe closely linked to his actual life. Do we feel like this is written directly as a response to that?
That's a great question, Tim, that I was thinking about all through part two. And there are things that make you think maybe, like maybe the novel's come out and it's a big hit and he feels like he has to say something. But then there are places in his own account where you would expect him to say more or offer a more robust defense, unless he's just intentionally contradicting some of the details of the novel. Like there are issues with the timeline that differ so dramatically from the novel.
Right.
For instance, when his wife gets sick, why and when she starts.
And this takes us into what Heidi wanted to talk about, the differences.
Yeah, when and why she starts her philanthropic enterprises and when he takes an interest in them. Is it because she's sick and confined to the house? That's what he says in the novel. That's her health, right? That's her reason for getting up. She gets sick and so she can't go for walks anymore. And they used to take their walks together, he says. In the novel, she relished going for her walks alone, and she stopped taking them because of all of the potentially criminal activities that he was involved in that soured the people of the city on her and their family. He was absent from her. He was absent when she died. He had no direct impact or involvement in her medical care, right, in his own account, which is very different. So it could be that he has just tried to get out in front of some of these things and tell his own story. But if he's writing in response to the novel, I would almost expect it to be more combative in some of those places where he shies away from the moments of conflict altogether.
Which makes you wonder why he never finished it. No follow
through. To me, the most interesting question of part two, by a mile, the most interesting question to me is, what is the deal with the absolute disparity between the portrayal of Mildred Bevel in his autobiography and Helen Rask in the
novel.
In the novel, not just in their illness, although that is interesting to me. And
right, it's not a mental illness at all in his
that
autobiography.
Clarifies and raises some really interesting questions. But to me, it is there's almost nothing in common between the core nature and personhood right. of Helen and Mildred. That is, to me, the mystery.
Yeah.
After part two. And brings me back to the original question I have, which is why write this at all if I were him? If it is justifying himself and he's justifying in the second half when he's talking about the money, why, what is he justifying about his wife?
Part of what's interesting about that is that, how do I say this? When I first read it, I don't know that I trusted the novelist more than I trusted his autobiography with regards to his wife. You know, because...
Yeah, how do you know?
How do you know?
Who's more reliable on that?
Right,
yeah.
Right. But it did, I mean, what you're saying, Heidi, exactly right. Like, what's going on here? But it's so interesting because we don't know what's going on, but we don't feel like, I didn't feel like I got anything anywhere closer to who she really was necessarily.
Right.
So Heidi, do you think
he becomes clearer and she becomes less clear?
Yes, right, right.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, David.
No. By the end of the book, without giving anything away, other than just answering this in the starkest terms.
Don't give anything away.
Do you think that becomes more clear?
Yes.
That
what being, you're saying there, Tim.
Wait, can you say exactly what I'm saying? I'm not sure that I know what the answer, what's the question that, is.
David?
Yeah.
The disparity between who the portrayals? Or, yeah, who she is?
Yes. Well, that you can, that by the end, you can trust any of the portrayals any more than we think we can now.
Yeah.
Okay.
I do.
And I'm going to add to the mystery by saying, I do not.
You don't think that you can trust 3 and 4?
Mm-mm.
Really? Oh, we are ripe for a debate.
I think that 1 and 2, you become even more of a mystery when you read 3 and 4.
Yeah.
And then that adds to whether you can trust. We'll talk about off the air. Well, trust
is the title of the book. So this is going to be an important debate.
I think the whole book in a way, and I think the whole book in a way, this is why it's metafictional, is an exercise in all the themes of the book, but also in how a narrator can mess with you and how you have to ask yourself, you have to be careful how you read it. But also how we deceive ourselves.
I totally agree with that. Everything you're saying, yes.
The versions of ours.
By my yes.
Okay, well, we'll have to talk about it when we get there and or off the air. Off the air, like we're live right now on the radio.
We're live.
So I was going to ask a different question. I forgot what it was.
Before we end the podcast, I want to ask the question of, can we think of other examples of metafiction?
Cloud Atlas.
Yeah.
I've never read Cloud Atlas.
Don't.
I haven't either.
Really, it's not so great.
Don't, but it's an example.
Don't, but it's an example.
So how does that book work?
It's about like a soul that is reborn in multiple times in a different person, and how that it's like the same soul but reincarnates in all these different times. And then so the story of this person, this soul's life, how it's like shaped by its time and place every time it's reborn.
And it's not as self-referential, but you as the reader sort of take in the whole of this story, which is story upon story upon story.
Yeah. And I mean, the novel absolutely concludes that there is no objective self.
Yeah. Like we're just products of the time, place, environment that we live in. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's dumb, but it was a good idea.
I mean, Don Quixote is considered metafiction.
Yeah, sure.
What makes Don Quixote metafiction?
So is Canterbury Tales.
I mean, if you're using modern constructs upon classic literature.
I mean, metafiction is just fiction that is self-aware about its own narrative structure and in a way that inherently alludes to, like, it makes the audience conscious of the fact that they're reading fiction.
Yeah, okay. I was maybe less Chaucer, but Don Quixote, because at least in the second half, you have a narrator who is purportedly the author, and he's talking about the reception of his own work, and I mean, that's metafictional.
What about something like The Trial by Franz Kafka or Metamorphosis? It's
By Kafka?
Not really author looking or back at like the book that he's published as an object, but he's still kind of like he's outside of the timeline that he created himself. So it's not that, but it does make you like, you're always asking, wait, what is going on? And it kind of lifts you up out of the text in this way that like forces you to be really cerebral about it. I don't know. I'm fishing here. I don't really know what metafiction is.
Yeah. Well, how about Neverending Story?
That was a book too.
Yeah.
Question mark.
Princess Bride is metafiction.
What is it? Okay, what is it? We need like a working, we have all these examples,
well,
but does anyone know what it is?
Yeah, David just gave the definition. You want to give
like you're
again?
Aware of the fact
here,
that
I'll
it's...
just pull up an official one.
Okay.
But it's basically a book that through its narrative structure is reminding you throughout that you're reading fiction.
A book that acknowledges that it's a book.
Yeah, that and that you're not, you can't just get lost in the story and be and completely get lost in it. You getting lost in the story is to be aware that you're reading a story, and the structure, and it's like pointing you towards the structural elements in it, as opposed to trying to bury them within the story. And then the more postmodern it got, the more it started to play with language and form and all that kind of stuff. But I think the simplest definition, it can be metafiction if it's just making the reader aware of its of the fact that it's telling a story.
This so what is about probably something like David Foster Wallace. Like, you know, his pages are just like littered with footnotes, or yeah, footnotes. And there's a kind of like always self-referencing.
I was just thinking about that too. Or like Slaughterhouse Five.
Oh, Slaughterhouse Five is definitely.
You think so? Because I'm wondering where the line is. I obviously like a simple "and reader, I married her." You know, like a simple breaking the fourth wall kind of thing isn't metafiction. But there has to be maybe a spectrum or a continuum where the one bleeds into the other. How much can the narrator talk to the reader before it becomes something other than just the passing?
I think if the narrator is talking to you and being like,
"See like, what I did there?"
yeah, basically. Or yeah. Like, okay, so a great example of this actually comes to mind. Anthony Horowitz. Have you guys read his mystery novels?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Okay.
It's like a modern Sherlock Holmes type thing where Anthony Horowitz, the author, is in his own books as himself, and he befriends. He doesn't really befriend. He works with a detective named Hawthorne, who is like Sherlock Holmes and kind of curmudgeonly and all that. And his job is to write a book about it. And so then he's very self-aware about the fact that he is writing books about this guy, and he's a character in his own story. And then the version of himself in the story isn't really him, but it has a lot of the markings of him. Like the version of Horowitz in the Horowitz books has also written the books that Horowitz in real life wrote and worked on the TV shows and stuff, but he isn't necessarily married to the same person, and doesn't have all the same characteristics. That's a good example of a model. I think it has to be expressively communicating with the audience that what you're engaged in is the work of storytelling and the work of fiction, as opposed to just talking to the audience. That's just voice. Like in Jane Eyre, it's just narrative voice.
Everything sad is untrue. Metafiction?
I can text Daniel real quick. Should we find out what he says?
Bro, is it metafiction?
Did you write metafiction?
The question I have...
I wrote a great story. That's what I was trying to do.
Do you think that for some readers, I could see this book being like that sort of metafictional self-awareness that's going on, that's, you know, it's asking you to compare different versions of the same story, and they're working in different forms and according to different archetypes. Do you think that's something that is like too self-aware? It's going to be annoying to people, Heidi?
No, I would be surprised if it was. I think this is the best modern example of it that I've ever read. That's why I love it. In general, metafiction feels a little bit too
clever.
I don't know.
Cute?
Like pretentious.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And self-referential on the part of the author. Like, look what I'm doing. Do you see what I'm doing here?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it just shoves the author's cleverness in your face.
Like what this section does for its narrator.
But I don't think this book does that at all.
Yeah.
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 Like it just gives us four different versions of the same story in very different ways from completely different perspectives, and then asks us the question that is raised by the title, which is, what can you trust? And it trusts the reader to be able to piece that together to the extent that the reader cares. And so the author, Hernán Díaz, I think, achieves what metafiction needs in order to not become pretentious and overly clever, which is what Keats called negative capability, when the author removes himself or herself from the story and doesn't tell us how to interpret it. And the problem with metafiction in general is that the author can't keep himself out of the work and continues to try to control it because he's being so clever.
Yeah.
And In this story, our author doesn't do that at all. He just gives us four independent manuscripts written by four different narrators that about the same story. And is like, here you go. Now it's on you. You, the reader, not me, the author, is the detective here, so to speak, of the mystery. And that's why after reading it, David can say, I still don't think you can completely trust it. Where I say, I think you can, right? And that both are completely legitimate because Hernan Diaz is just giving it to us and removing himself from it. And that's why I think this is a great example of successful metafiction. When some of the others, I just roll my eyes and I'm like, thanks for being such a smarty pants.
Yeah.
Maybe it's like an M.C. Escher. Painting. I don't know if you call M.C. Escher a painting, but like, you see the cleverness, you see how it self refers, but are you moved by an Escher painting? Probably not. Your cerebral cortex is kind of firing. Oh my gosh. Oh gosh. It's myself looking back.
Look what you've done.
Oh my gosh. But I don't think like, oh, I can't believe it. A house with multiple staircases feeding itself. You know, like you don't have an
emotion. My soul is alive. Life is a wonder.
My soul is,
That's everything where, like, is symbolic, and I, the painter, get it, and you don't, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, right. Without me, how would you ever see?
That's a really good example.
I do think that most of the best metafiction is like, is just kind of having fun, and you don't have to take it. Like, I think that's why I like the Hawthorne Horowitz books, because they're metafiction, but like, he's just having a good time.
Because they're just fun. Yeah.
Yeah. He's not trying to be like, I mean, he's trying to be clever because he's writing a mystery story. Like, that's the name of the game, but he's not like so our friend Jared, he likes to say when he thinks something's annoying or like too clever, he's like, it insists upon itself.
It's not insisting upon himself. No.
In fact, he's kind of making fun of himself.
Yeah.
And here, as to your point, Diaz isn't going out of his way to make himself seem clever. He's just telling a good story. And in through these different modes. Sean, as we come to the end of this conversation, how are you feeling about what's coming next? Like the mystery, and like, do you feel like it's been more unlocked for you, or are you more confused, or what are you looking for? What clues do you need?
It has definitely deepened. I mean, I'm sure that's what we're going to get in the next two parts, but the clues that I need are other accounts from real people, more voices, because we've got a fictional version of this guy's life with no context. I don't know if this is a, you know, an activist novelist with an axe to grind, or a former friend of the family, or, you know, someone who knew his wife and thought he never treated her right. And no, he's setting the record straight. I don't know. And probably we'll never know. I don't know. Maybe the latter parts reveal something about the author. And then this fellow who's clearly not the best objective judge of himself, but that doesn't mean that he's dishonest. So I don't, I need some more. I need a third point to triangulate by. But the mystery.
Boy, do we have
deepened.
Good news for you, Sean.
And
can you imagine, how would you guys feel? I know we're wrapping up, but how would you guys feel if the novel closed after part two?
Trust?
Disappointed.
Yeah,
yeah.
It would be a failure.
Yeah, for sure.
You think it would be a failure? You wouldn't be like, frustrated. I want to know, like, which of these two accounts is,
there must be a sequel coming.
Right.
Yeah, I think feel like that. It's the knowledge that there's more to come that makes me care at this point.
Yeah.
One thing that I like about part three, this isn't going to give anything too much away, is that the world of the novel expands. Like it becomes more novelistic in some ways, which isn't to say that we didn't have enough in these two parts, but the impact of what's happening in their lives, we see that more broadly, and the writing changes. I love how the narrative voice can changes between all the different sections. And in some ways you feel like it's revealing itself more and more. And then all of a sudden it stops revealing itself. Then, well, it doesn't stop revealing itself. It just gets deeper again. And I think this is, Diaz just keeps showing his chops a little bit more at a time. That's one of the reasons why I like this section. I totally understand, Heidi, why number section 4 is your favorite. Or yeah, that's what you said.
Yeah,
after
it
the
is.
First reading. You went back and read that section again after the first one, right?
Well, it is. There's a couple of different reasons why I love it a lot. Part of it is I just love the narrator. Like, as a person, I really love the narrator.
Mm.
Interesting.
And we'll come to that.
Yeah.
I feel like that was a spoiler.
Well, this fourth one, though, or this third section is delightful.
Okay.
Like, it's really fun and really, really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm excited.
And during that section, we have to talk about the idea of memory. I mean, it's a memoir remembered or whatever is the section's title, but it's a big theme. Tim, anything that you want people to be looking for or any final thoughts?
I think everybody's going to snap into sleuth mode, you know? Mm. And I think that's Lisa. The exact right. Yeah. Yeah. That's the right orientation.
I would love to see Aaron Diaz actually write a mystery novel. Like he should write a detective story.
He did. It's called Trust. You are the second.
But then, yep.
It could be called Lies.
Ooh.
I don't know. It's not, great. We'll workshop that.
We'll work on it.
Heidi, what are you? Any final thoughts?
No, I just everything we already said. I don't know how you could read these two and not keep reading. Like you just, at this point, you just have to read more.
Yeah,
for sure.
And it
how
just gets better.
Keep
it
going.
Gets better. Yeah.
Sean, given the tweed that you're wearing right now, I just have to ask, what's your favorite chess opening?
Well,
I just assume
I'm going to dodge this one and say the short guy in front of the king, you move that one out too. So get your queen rocking and rolling real quick.
No, there's Sean. I feel like you were one of those kids that was a chess prodigy.
You know,
you just rope it up everybody.
I do really enjoy chess, but I have never learned that much about it. My kids know a lot more about chess than I do.
Mm. Chess club.
Yeah, that's right.
It's online. It's chess is back, you guys.
But we play it a
online
lot. We really
chess
love chess.
Chess is everywhere.
Yeah.
Jack loves online. He plays with like all his friends. Online chess sweeping the nation.
After Magnus, we finally had like a chess rock star that reinvigorated interest in the sport.
You know, speaking of Anthony Horowitz, his newest book, which just came out last week, the opening opening involves a chess pro.
Nice.
So detective fiction with a chess pro. That's all I'm going to say. Heidi, do you have a favorite chess opening? Since chess is a thing in your house.
The Queen's Gambit.
Smart. Wow.
Wait,
smart,
are you serious?
No, I just watched the show and that's the only chess opening I know.
That's my favorite opening.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, the Queen's Gambit is great.
Oh,
it's like,
good.
It makes like for a super open game, you have to, you take a risk right at the beginning.
Yeah, that's right.
It's super exciting. It's daring. And you get a fast moving game. You don't get one of these like turgid, you know, like, oh my gosh. Yeah, sluggish with like pawn laden. My gosh, no.
Yeah, not Sean's playing the pawn laden game.
Nobody wants to play that one.
Sean plays a pawn laden game. Everybody says that about you, Sean.
Yeah, they do.
Sorry that you had to hear it on the air.
Yeah.
Well, what are you going to do?
That's right.
What are you going to do?
I mean, it's best, at least you heard it. Now you can work.
Now you can decide what to
make
do
some
with
adjustments.
That.
Yeah,
I'm gonna lean
really
into
wish
it.
I knew chess because Tim was so proud of me for like 4.5 seconds.
Should have owned it.
I really was. I was like, it's so great. Queen's Gambit is so great.
Are you a legit good chess player, Tim? I mean, not,
I don't know.
Like,
what,
not could
I don't
you
know
be
where
like
that...
one of the top players in the world, but like, are you pretty good?
Where are you ranked among the people in your household?
Oh, come on! Like, actually, Galen would probably beat me. But she hasn't played in a while. But if we worked at it, I think you'd start beating me. She's better. Like, she's more analytical in that way.
That doesn't surprise me at all. I would have put my money on Galen every time.
Yeah. What? Not my kid? What? What is it with, there's like, you can't say anything nice about Arden? My gosh.
It's just the fine motor skills. I'm sure she would blow you away if, you know.
She's too pawn laden. She's too defensive.
Tim doesn't like to play her style, so they don't.
It's all for her. Yeah,
that's right. I like chess, but I get bored with it.
Like, you get chess bored with it.
Did you just say? Speak more clearly. You said you get bored with it.
Yeah, I said what I said. Yeah, I get.
Okay, can I actually advocate for something that is a really fun way to play chess? Next time you've got four people that are all around roughly the same level, play two player per side. So if it was like David and Heidi against Sean and Tim, Sean and Tim cannot communicate to each other.
You two cannot
communicate with each
other. Do we alternate taking turns?
Yes.
Okay, so this is how I want to play this.
Ooh, yeah.
Sean and Heidi versus Tim and David.
Yeah.
And two moves in, David and I go drink wine.
How's your chess game? It was great. It was the best chess game. I had a queen gambit.
I want to do.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
People just like sitting there looking ahead and a lot of
thinking about stuff.
I mean, it's thinking about stuff, and I mean, it's cool. Maybe it's just because I'm not that good at it. I play people, I lose. Anyway, should we probably wrap this up now?
I guess.
You know, we're just kind of talking now. I was going to ask you guys what your favorite M&M flavor is, but we can save that for another day. All right. Well, we will be back next week with a conversation on part 3 and then the following week, part 4. And then, of course, the Q&A. Feel free to leave your comments on the threads over on Substack. That's closereads.substack.com for Close Reads HQ. And, of course, don't forget about all the great content that we are creating, including future summer-themed episodes on things such as travel and books on chess. With that, for Tim McIntosh, for Heidi White, and for Sean Johnson, I am David Kern. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, happy reading.